she would have gotten copied on the FBI subpoena. But my guess is she saw that as a shot in the dark, I said. A fishing expedition, to see if the feds had anything. Even the judge thought that. Anyway, I don't want to go for a subpoena yet. That will give the prosecution too much time to cover our ground. So, we need to find him first, and then watch him until it's time.
That can be done, Sisko said. But it will cost. I didn't realize we were talking about running this up to the trial.
How much? I asked.
We're running $4,000 a day with the surveillance package we've got out there now, Sisko said.
I looked at Lorna, the keeper of the practice's bank accounts. She shook her head.
We're 4 weeks out from trial, she said. You'll need $100,000 to keep it going, Mickey. We don't have that.
Unless you go back to Andre Lacoste or Bosch, Jennifer said. They got off easy on your bail, but had been willing to pony up 6 figures each.
No on Bosch, I said. I should be paying him rather than asking him for money.
Lorna, see if you can set up a dinner between me and Andre. I'll see what he's willing to do.
Maybe Sisko can negotiate a discount, Lorna said, looking across the table at her husband. Mickey is a repeat client, after all.
I can try for it, Sisko said. I knew that he probably got a piece of any business he brought to the Indians, so Lorna's suggestion hit him in his own wallet.
Good, I said.
So what about the FBI? Jennifer said, changing the subject. The FOIA and subpoena went nowhere. We could formally go to the U.S. attorney with a TUI letter, but we all know the feds can just sit on it, and it won't work with our time frame.
What's a TUI letter? Sisko asked.
Step one in a protocol for demanding a federal agent's testimony, Jennifer said. Named after an Illinois convict whose case created it.
You're right, though, I said. It'll take forever. But there might be an end run with the Bureau. And if we make enough waves at BioGreen, or at least threaten to, they may come to the table.
Good luck with that, Jennifer said.
Yeah, luck is what we need, I said. And that put a solemn cap on the meeting.
Chapter 27. Wednesdays had always been my night with my daughter, but things had shifted with law school. She had a tort study group that met at 7, so I was relegated to the early bird special. We'd meet on campus or close by for a quick and early dinner, and then she would go off to the law school and the group's meeting room. I had Bishop drop me off at the gate on Exposition Boulevard. Before getting out, I handed $60 over the seat to him.
Pick me up here in 2 hours, I said.
Meantime, use that money to buy me a prepaid burner and then get yourself something to eat with the rest. If there's time after that, set up the burner. I'll need to make a call on it when I get back.
You got it, Bishop said.
You want to be able to text?
Not necessary. If it goes right, I'll make one call and receive another. That's it.
I walked across campus from there to Morton Figg in the student center. I found Haley at an outside table near the towering tree the restaurant was named for. And to my surprise, she was sitting with her mother. They were on the same side of the table, so when I sat down, I was facing them both.
Well, this is a nice surprise, I said.
Good to see you, Mags.
Good to see you, too.
Are you going to eat? Maggie asked.
That's why I'm here, I said, and to see our daughter.
Well, you don't look like you're eating, she countered. You've been out of lockup for, what, a month? And it looks like you're still losing weight. What's going on with you, Mickey?
What is this, an intervention? I asked.
We're worried about you, Dad, Haley said. I asked Mom to come.
Yeah, well, try being charged with a murder you didn't commit, I said. It wears you down, whether you're in jail or not.
How can we help? Maggie said. I paused before answering, while a waitress brought us menus. Maggie refused a menu, saying she wasn't going to eat.
You're here to tell me that I have to start eating, but you're not going to eat? I said.
I know these dinners are special, Maggie said, for both of you.
going all the way back to when you used to get pancakes at the Dupars that isn't there anymore. I just wanted to see you and ask how you're doing, then let you two be together.
You can stay, I said. We would always make room for you.
No, I have plans, Maggie said. I'm going to go, but you didn't answer my question. How can we help you, Mickey?
Well, I said, you could start by telling your colleague, Iceberg, that she's so blinded by the idea of having me as a trophy on her shelf that she's not seeing the case for what it really is. A set... Maggie waved her hands to cut me off.
I'm talking about what we could do outside the courtroom, she said. This is an extremely awkward work situation, as you know. They've kept me far away from the case because of the conflict of interest. But I don't even have to see the case or the evidence to know there's no way you did this. Just as I know you're going to win the case. Haley and I could never think otherwise. But you need to be able to win the case, and your physical health is key. And you look like shit, Mickey. I'm sorry, but I've seen you in court. Haley said you've got your suits altered, but you still look like skin and bones. You've got circles under your eyes. You don't look confident. You don't look like the Lincoln lawyer we know and love.
I was silent. Her words hit hard because I knew they were sincere. Thank you, I finally said. I mean that. It's a good reminder. Act like a winner, you'll become a winner. That's the rule, and I guess I forgot it. You can't act like a winner if you don't look like one. It's all about sleep, I think. It's hard to sleep, with this hanging over me.
See a doctor, Maggie said. Get a prescription.
I shook my head. No prescriptions, I said. But I'll figure something out.
Should we order? You sure you can't stay? The food here is great.
I can't, she said. I really do have a meeting, and I want you and Hay to visit. She was just telling me that she's learning more watching you in court than in the hallowed hallways of USC law. Anyway, I'm going to go now. Maggie pushed back her chair.
Thanks, Mags, I said. It means a lot.
Take care of yourself, she said. And then she did a surprising thing. After leaning down and kissing Haley on the cheek, she came around the table to kiss me as well. It was the first time in too many years for me to remember.
Bye, guys, she said.
I watched her go and was silent for a few moments.
Do they really call her that? Haley asked.
What? I asked.
Iceberg.
Yeah, they do. She laughed, and then I did too. The waitress came, and we ordered off the happy hour menu. Haley had lobster tacos, and, inspired by Maggie's skin and bones comment, I ordered the classic hamburger with grilled onions, even though I'd had a late lunch. During the meal, we mostly talked about her classes. She was at a stage where the law was a wonderful thing, with protections for all and equitable punishments for the offenders. It was an exciting time, and I remembered it well. It was when ideals were set and goals attached to them. I let her talk and mostly just smiled and nodded my head. My mind was on Maggie, the things she had said, and the kiss at the end.
Now you,
Haley said at one point. I looked up, a French fry ready to go in my mouth.
What do you mean? I asked.
All we've been talking about is me and the theoretical world of law, she said. What about you and the real world? How's the case going?
What case?
Dad!
Just kidding. It's going well. We're coming up with some good stuff, I think.
I'm beginning to see the trial come together. There was a football coach. I can't remember who it was. Maybe Belichick, the Patriots guy. Anyway, he would call the first 12 plays of the game for the offense a couple days before the game even started. He'd look at film of the other team, study their habits, decide what he expected them to do on defense, and write out the plays. That's the place I'm getting to. I can see things falling into place, witnesses, evidence.
But you don't get to go until after the prosecution.
True, but I pretty much know what they're going to do. I mean, we're 4 weeks out, so there's plenty of time for things to change, and maybe they surprise me. But right now, I'm thinking about my case, not the state's, and I'm beginning to feel good about it.
That's great, I already talked to all of my professors and told them I needed to be there.
Look, I know you're with me on it, but you don't have to be there and miss school. Maybe come for openers, and then I'll let you know if there's something you might want to see, then the verdict and the celebration afterward.
I smiled, hoping she would share my optimism.
Dad, don't jinx yourself, she said instead.
Is that what they teach you at USC Law? I said. How not to jinx a case?
No, that's third year.
Funny girl. We went our separate ways outside the restaurant. I walked off, but then stopped to watch her make her way through the plaza. It was dark now, but the campus was well lit. She walked with confidence and a fast step. I watched until she disappeared between two buildings. Bishop was waiting for me at the appointed spot. I got in the rear passenger door. He handed a cheap flip phone over the seat to me, as well as change from my 60.
Did you get something to eat? I asked.
I went over to Tam's on Fig, he said. I had a hamburger too.
Hit the spot. So, where to?
Just hold right here a minute while I make a call. On my real phone, I Googled the number for the FBI's Los Angeles field office and called it on the burner. It was answered by a male voice and a curt, FBI.
Yes, I need to get a message to an agent.
There's nobody in right now. Everybody's gone home.
I know. Can you please get a message to Agent Don Ruth?
You'll have to do that tomorrow.
It's an emergency call from a confidential informant. Tomorrow will be too late.
There was a long pause, and then he relented.
Is this the number she needs to call?
Yes, and the name is Walter Lennon.
Walter Lennon, got it.
Please call her now. Thank you.
I closed the burner and looked over the seat at Bishop.
Okay, drive. I'm going to be moving if she calls back. Harder to track us that way.
Anywhere?
Tell you what, head toward your place. I can drop you off tonight instead of you dropping me and taking an Uber.
You sure?
Yeah, go. I want to be moving.
Bishop pulled the Lincoln away from the curb and started driving. He was soon on the 110 freeway going south. I knew he would connect to the 105 and turn west toward Inglewood. We were in the carpool lane and making good time. As we took the exit to the 105, the burner phone started to buzz with a call. Caller ID was blocked. I flipped it open, but didn't speak. Soon I heard a woman's voice.
Who is this?
Agent Ruth, thanks for calling. It's Mick Haller.
Haller? What the hell are you doing?
Is this a private line? I don't think you want this recorded.
Yes, it's private. What exactly is this about?
Well, it's about Walter Lennon. And the fact that you called me back so quick pretty much confirms you know exactly who he is. Make that was.
Haller, you have about 3 seconds before I hang up. Why are you calling me?
I'm taking a gamble, Agent Ruth. The other night when your partner Aiello wanted to throw me off the deck, you pulled him back. I've seen a lot of tape in my time of the good cop, bad cop routine, and I don't think that's what was going on there. You didn't like what he was doing. I'm asking you one more time before hanging up, what do you want?
Well, for one thing, I want you to testify.
I heard sarcastic laughter.
And, barring that, I said, undaunted, I want you to tell me what was going on with Sam Scales, a.k.a. Walter Lennon, and Biogreen.
You're crazy, Haller, Ruth said. You expect me just to throw my job away?
I expect you to do the right thing, is all. Isn't that why you became an FBI agent?
I'm basing this on what happened the other night, but I'm guessing that whatever is going on, this cover-up, you're not down with it. Your partner may be all in, but you're not. You know I didn't kill Sam Scales, and you can help me prove it.
I'll say it again. You're crazy if you think I'm going to throw away my career for you. And no, I don't know whether or not you killed Sam Scales.
Well, maybe you don't have to throw away your career. Maybe you can do the right thing and still keep it.
I know this. Your partner isn't keeping his.
What are you talking about?
He was going to throw me off the deck. Please, you're exaggerating. He was over the top, I'll give you that. But you were pushing our buttons, Holler. And he wasn't threatening to push you over. That's totally insane. I didn't respond, so she kept going. Besides, it would be your word against two agents. Do the math on that. Is that why you guys always travel in pairs? She didn't respond. I pressed on. Look, Agent Ruth, for some reason, I like you. It's not been my experience with feds, but like I said, you pulled him off me. So I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to stop you from filing a false report on that incident when I make the complaint. It'll probably save your job, and then maybe you'll do right by me. I don't know what you're talking about now. Do you have a private email address? Give it to me, and I'll send you something tonight. You'll know what I'm talking about then. I have a camera on that balcony, Agent Ruth. I caught the whole thing. It would be the word of two agents against a video. You would lose. There was a long silence, and I looked out the window. I saw we were going by the new billion-dollar football stadium. Then I heard Ruth recite an email address. I snapped on the overhead light and wrote it down on a legal pad. Okay, I said. I'll send you the video as soon as I get home and get steady Wi-Fi. Probably be an hour. Hopefully, I hear something back from you and this whole thing can be avoided for you and your partner. She disconnected without a further word. I put the burner into my jacket pocket and snapped off the overhead light. That video must be pretty good, huh? Bishop asked from the front seat. I stared at him in the darkness, his face catching a dim glow from the dashboard lights. I once again wondered about Sisko having cleared him as a possible spy for the prosecution. Either way, he didn't need to know my business. Nah, I said. I was just bluffing. Chapter 28. Thursday, January 16th. The next morning came quickly, thanks to a 7 a.m. hammering on the front door. Kendall jumped out of bed first, and then I sat up so fast, I thought I felt a muscle in my lower back twinge. "What is it?" she cried. "I don't know," I said. "Just get dressed." I pulled on the pants I had discarded on the floor the night before and grabbed a fresh shirt out of the closet. I buttoned it as I walked barefoot down the hall, the dread growing with each step that I might be going back to Twin Towers. Only the cops pounded on your door this early. I opened the door, and sure enough, there was Drucker and another detective I didn't recognize. Behind them stood two uniformed officers. Drucker was holding up a document I did recognize, a search warrant. "Hello, sir. We have a warrant to search these premises," Drucker said. "May we come in?" "Let's see what you've got," I said. I took the warrant, which was several pages stapled together. I knew to skip through all the preamble and the probable cause statement to get to the meat of what they were looking for. "You want billing records," I said. "I don't have any of that stuff here. My office manager has all of the current stuff, and the rest is in storage." "My partner is serving a warrant to Miss Taylor's residence," Drucker said, "and we have a third for your storage unit. I was hoping you would cooperate and meet us there to facilitate that search after this." I stepped back from the doorway and held my arm out, signaling them to enter. I noticed Kendall in the door to the hallway leading to the back. She was holding up my phone. "It's Lorna," she said. "Tell her I know she's getting searched," I said. "I'll call her back in 5. I turned to the four law officers now standing in my living room. "I have a home office in the back," I said. "I assume you'll want to start there, but like I said, I don't keep billing records here. Lorna handles all of that." Drucker was not put off. "If you could show us the way," he said, "we'll try to make this as painless as possible." They followed me down the hall. I saw that Kendall had retreated to our bedroom and closed the door. As we went by, I knocked on the door to get her attention. "Kendall, I need to stay with these guys," I said. "Will you bring me some socks and my shoes?"
I then moved to the last door in the hallway, which led to a bedroom I'd converted into an office. There was a desk covered in paperwork and files. "These are case files that contain privileged information you're not entitled to look at," I said. I reached down and started opening drawers in the desk so they would see they were mostly empty. "Knock yourself out, but as you can see, no billing records," I said. "You're wasting your time and mine." I moved back around from behind the desk so there was room for the searchers. There was a couch in the office where I slept on occasion. I sat down as Kendall entered with a fresh pair of socks and my black lace-up Ferro Aldo boots. She also handed me my cell phone.
"You people are unbelievable," Kendall said. "Why don't you just leave him alone?"
"It's okay, Kendall," I said. "They're wrong, but they're just doing their job. The sooner we let them get to it, the sooner they're out of here." Kendall left the room in a huff. I called Lorna back.
"Mickey, they're searching my records," she said upon answering.
"I know," I said. "They can look at the billing. Just make sure they're not looking at privileged material."
"I'm not letting them near that, but, you know, all the stuff with Sam Scales is not here."
"Detective Drucker is here. I told him that. But they're going to do what they want to do." Lorna lowered her voice to a whisper for her next question.
"What does this mean, Mickey? What are they looking for?"
I hadn't really had time to think about those questions. I told Lorna I would call her back and disconnected. I then sat on the couch, unmoving, as I watched Drucker and the unnamed detective going through the drawers of my desk. The uniformed officers were milling about in the hallway. They were there to enforce the search if there was pushback. But since I was cooperating, they had nothing to do but stand with their hands on their equipment belts. I knew that Death Row Dana was shoring up her case. I guessed that this search was about accounts receivable and motive. They were looking for documentation that Sam Scales had stiffed me. They wanted my own records to prove it, and that told me that the murder for financial gain charge was still in play. A few minutes later, Drucker closed all the drawers in the desk and looked at me. "Let's check the garage," he said. "There's nothing in the garage," I said. "The California bar frowns on client records being stored in unsecured locations. You want to just skip all of this and go to my warehouse? I know what you're looking for, and if I have it, it's there."
"Where's your warehouse?"
"Over the hill, Studio City." "Let's check the garage and then go."
"Whatever."
It was too early for Bishop to be around. After the garage was cleared, my first time being in there since the murder, I drove the Lincoln, and as I made my way north through Laurel Canyon, I thought about how many times I had chided clients for being cooperative with the people working to take away their freedom. "Do you think by being nice and helping them out, you'll convince them you didn't do it? Not a chance. These people want to take everything away from you, your family, your home, your freedom. Do not cooperate with them." And yet here I was, leading a parade of police cars to the place where I kept the records of my practice and livelihood. This was the moment when I thought maybe I did have a fool for a client. Maybe I should have just told Drucker to fuck off and let him find the warehouse on his own, then cut the locks and figure out where the files were. My phone buzzed, and it was Lorna again.
"I thought you were going to call me back."
"Sorry, I forgot." "Well, they're gone. I heard them say they were going to the warehouse."
"Yeah, I'm heading there now."
"Mickey, what are the chances they're going to finish their search and then arrest you on new charges?" "I thought about that. But they let me drive my own car and lead them up here. No way Drucker would have done that if he had an arrest warrant in his pocket."
"I hope you're right. Have you heard from Jennifer yet today?"
"Not yet." "Okay, I'll call her to let her know what's going on. Hang in there, Lorna."
"I just wish this would all be over."
"Me too." I led the police brigade up Lancashire to the climate-controlled warehouse where I kept my records, along with male and female mannequins and other props I had used at trials over the years. I also had two racks of suits there of various sizes that I kept for clients to wear in court, and the third of my three Lincoln Town Cars. There was also an upright AMSEC gun safe for when I took firearms in trade for services rendered. As a condition of my bail, I could have no firearms, so I'd had Cisco take the guns to the home he shared with Lorna until the case came to an end. The warehouse had a roll-up garage door, which I opened for the searchers. I then led them to a locked storage room within the warehouse, where I kept archived records in locked filing cabinets, in full compliance with California bar guidelines for securing client records. I used a key to unlock the first four-drawer cabinet. "Have at it, gentlemen," I said. "This row contains the business records going back to 05, I believe. You will find the P's and O's, the accounting and tax returns, all the financial stuff. That's what you were entitled to under the scope of the warrant. The other drawers contain case files, and they're off-limits, even the Sam Scales files." The room was too small for the whole group, which now included Drucker's partner, Lopez. I backed out of the room to where the uniformed cops stood, and I hovered by the doorway, where I could keep a watch on the search. There was a folding table in the file storage room that I used when I had to look through old case files. The detectives remained standing, but opened the files they were interested in on the table. If there was something they wanted to take, they placed it to the side. With the three of them working it, the search was conducted quickly, and by the time they were finished, they had placed four documents aside to seize under the authority of the search warrant. I asked to see them. "There's nothing in the warrant that directs me to share with you what we seize," Drucker said. "And there's nothing in there that directs me to cooperate with you," I said. "But I did. Whatever you take, it comes back to me in discovery anyway, detective. So why be a dick about it?" "You know, Holler, you didn't have to be a dick yourself and rake me over the coals in public." "What? You're talking about the other day in court? If you think that's raking somebody over the coals, wait till you testify in front of the jury. Make sure you wear your Depends, detective." Drucker gave me a smile without a note of humor in it. "Have a good day," he said. He brushed by me, holding the documents to his chest so I could not get even a glimpse of them. Lopez and the unnamed detective followed him out. Then the whole entourage of detectives and uniformed escorts left the warehouse. I texted Lorna to let her know I had not been rearrested. Yet. Chapter 29. Friday, January 17th. The Catalina Express moved swiftly over the dark waters of the Pacific. The sun was just starting to dip behind the island that lay ahead of us. The wind was biting cold, but Kendall and I faced it on the open deck, arms wrapped around each other. It was Friday afternoon, and I had told Team Holler that I was disappearing for the holiday weekend. My bail restrictions prohibited me from leaving L.A. County without the judge's permission, so I chose a spot as far away as I could get without breaking the rules. The boat docked at the pier in the Avalon Harbor at 4 p.m., and there was a chauffeured golf cart from the Zane Grey Pueblo waiting for us. It carried us and our one bag up the hill, the driver making small talk about the renovations recently completed at the historic hotel, which had once been the home of the author and the place where he had written several of his novels about the Western frontier. "He lived out here because he loved the fishing," the driver said. "He always said that he wrote so he could fish, whatever that means." I just nodded and looked at Kendall. She smiled. "Did you know he was a dentist?" the driver asked. "Who was?" I asked. "Zane Grey," he said. "And that wasn't his real first name. His real name was Pearl, like the woman's name. No wonder he went by Zane. That was his middle name, actually." "Interesting," Kendall said. It was off-season, and the hotel was nearly empty. We had the pick of several rooms, all named after the author's most popular novels. We took the Riders of Purple Sage suite, not because I knew the book, but because it had a view of the harbor and a working fireplace.
I'd been in the room before, many times, many years ago, with Maggie McPherson, when we were still married. Our plan was to stay in for most of the weekend and enjoy each other's company. No phones, no computers, no intrusions. We did, however, rent a golf cart from the hotel for sorties to restaurants and the grocery store down in the town. The setup was great, but there was something sad for me about the trip. I was feeling depressed and couldn't shake it. Kendall and I spent time in front of the fireplace talking and reminiscing and planning, and we made love the first two nights and on Sunday morning. But by Monday, we had stopped talking about anything that mattered, and I sat most of the day in front of the flat screen, watching CNN reports on the ongoing impeachment saga, as well as the mystery virus in China. The Centers for Disease Control had announced that it was deploying medical staff to LAX to meet flights from Wuhan and check passengers for fever and other symptoms of illness. Those who were determined to be sick would be quarantined. The news was a diversion. I had made a good show of it, turning my phone off and never pulling it out of the suitcase the whole weekend. But I couldn't take my mind off other things. The weight of what was ahead and the stakes involved was coming down on me. I had the premonition that Kendall and I were spending our last days together, that her return to L.A. and our trying to rekindle our romance would ultimately be a failed experiment. I couldn't pinpoint exactly why this was, but thoughts intruded about Maggie and the meeting at USC that had briefly reunited our lost family. And the kiss. It was amazing to me how something so casual, quick, and unexpected could shake the fragile foundations of the relationship at hand. Chapter 30. Tuesday, January 21st. When Tuesday dawned, with a gray, overcast sky and heavy fog cover between the island and the mainland, it somehow seemed appropriate to me. The dread that had steadily built through the weekend was confirmed shortly after I turned on my phone for the first time in 3.5 days. Just as we were about to check out and head to the boat, I got a call from Jennifer Aronson. "Mickey, where are you?"
"Catalina."
"What?"
"Kendall and I went for the weekend, I told you. Anyway, we're about to head back. What's up?"
"I just got a call from Berg. They want you to turn yourself in. They dropped the current murder charge against you this morning, then got a grand jury indictment for murder with special circumstances. Financial gain."
That meant no bail.
I remained silent for a long moment and thought about Drucker going through my Sam Scales files. What did he take? Was there something in my files that had led to this? Kendall noticed the look on my face and whispered, "What is it?" I shook my head. I would tell her after the call. At the moment, I had to come up with a strategy for dealing with this. "Okay," I said. "Call Warfield's clerk. See if you can get on the calendar in the afternoon. I'll turn myself in then and there, but we..."
"What?"
Kendall shrieked. I held a hand up to quiet her and continued with Jennifer. "We ask for a probable cause hearing on the special circumstances allegation. This is bullshit."
"But the grand jury indictment obviates a preliminary hearing. It presumes probable cause."
"Doesn't matter. We need to get in front of the judge and convince her that this is a bullshit attempt by the prosecution to tilt the board and reset the game clock."
"Okay, that's the angle. Speedy trial. I can work on that. You need to get back here and be ready to argue. I think this is one where you need to address the court."
"Absolutely. You take probable cause, and I'll take the speedy trial argument. I'm on my way. Let me know if they're going to wait till the hearing or try to pick me up ahead of that. I've got the ankle monitor so they can find me if they want to."
"I'm on it."
We disconnected, and I turned to Kendall. "We have to go. They're going to arrest me again."
"How can they do that?"
"They dropped the original case, then went to the grand jury and got an indictment, and it all starts again."
"You're going to jail?"
She put her arms around me and hugged me as though she wouldn't let them take me away. "I'm going to do my best to get in front of the judge and argue against it, so we should go."
The ride on the Catalina Express back to San Pedro was through a thick fog. This time, Kendall and I stayed inside the cabin, sipping hot coffee and trying to remain calm. I walked her through the steps Berg had taken in turning me into a wanted man. Untrained in the law, Kendall said it was unfair even if it was a valid legal maneuver, and I couldn't argue with that. The prosecutor was using completely legal means to subvert a completely legal process. The crossing was slowed by the thick blanket of fog, and it was an hour before I heard and felt the boat's big engines thrum down as we slowly approached the harbor. I had not heard back from Jennifer and didn't know if I would be met at the dock by police who had tracked my monitor. I got up and moved to a forward-viewing window. If I was about to be arrested, I needed to prep Kendall on what to do and whom to call. The fog started to thin as we entered the harbor, and I saw the green span of the Vincent Thomas Bridge appear in the mist. Soon, I saw the ferry terminal, but I noticed no sign of law enforcement on the dock. The parking lot where I had left the Lincoln was not in view because of the terminal building. I returned to Kendall and handed her the keys to the Lincoln. "In case they're waiting for me," I said.
"Oh my God, Mickey, do you think they are?" she said.
"Take it easy. I didn't see anybody on the dock, and that's where they'd most likely be waiting. It'll probably be fine, but just in case, you have the keys and can drive back. But before you go anywhere, you call Jennifer and tell her what's happening. She'll know what to do. I'm going to text you her contact."
"Okay."
"Then call Haley and tell her too."
"Okay, I can't believe they're doing this."
She started to cry, and I hugged her and assured her that everything would be okay. Privately, I wasn't as certain as I sounded. We got off the boat and to the Lincoln without being stopped. My phone buzzed as we were getting in the car. It was Jennifer, but I didn't answer. I was paranoid and felt like a sitting duck. I wanted to get out of the parking lot and onto the freeway. A moving target was always harder to get a bead on. Once we were on the 110 going north, I called Jennifer back. "We're on the calendar for 3:00. "Good, and they aren't going to try to grab me in the meantime?"
"That's what Berg told the judge. You'll be allowed to surrender in her courtroom following a hearing at 3.
"Did Berg object to the hearing?"
"I don't know, but probably. But Warfield's clerk tipped me that the judge is a bit upset about this, about the bail part, since she set bail and now the DA's trying to take it away. So we'll have that going for us when we go in."
"Good. When and where do you want to meet beforehand?"
"I need time to work on points for your argument. How about 1? We could meet in the cafeteria at the courthouse."
I checked the dashboard clock. It was already 10:30.
1 is good, but not the courthouse. Too many badges around there, and somebody might try to be a hero and hook me up. Let's not get to the courthouse till it's time for the hearing."
"Got it. Where, then?"
"How about Rosso Blue? Since I might be back on a bologna diet after today, I'm going to eat some pasta for lunch."
"Okay, I'll be there." "One more thing, if you have time. Get a message to the twins who've been covering this for the papers. Make sure they know about the hearing. I'd do it, but I want to be able to say I didn't if Berg accuses me of it again. Still, the media should be there to see this bullshit."
"I'll call them."
We disconnected, and Kendall immediately spoke.
"I want to be with you in court."
"That would be nice, and I'll call Haley when we get home. I need to put on a suit and work a little bit on what I'm going to say to the judge, and then we'll go to lunch." I knew it was going to be a working lunch, and Kendall shouldn't be there because she was outside the privileged circle. But I also knew that my freedom could be down to these last few hours. I didn't want to exclude her. It took us almost an hour to get to the house. I parked at the curb next to the stairs, still not wanting to use the garage. Bishop was sitting on the stairs, waiting. I had told him Friday we would start at 10 on Tuesday, and he had been waiting. I had forgotten about him. Kendall went up the stairs while I got our suitcase out of the trunk.
"Let me help you with that," Bishop said.
"You're my driver, not my valet, Bishop," I said. "You've been waiting long?"
"Not too long."
"Sorry about that. But you're going to have to wait another hour while I get ready and do some work inside. Then we'll head downtown. You might be driving Kendall back by herself. What about you? I go back for you?
I don't think so. They're going to try to put me back in jail today, Bishop.
They can do that? You got bail.
They can try. They're the government, the beast, and the game is always rigged in the beast's favor.
I lugged the suitcase up the stairs and through the front door. Kendall was standing in the living room, holding an envelope out to me.
Somebody slid this under the door, she said.
I took the envelope and studied it while rolling the suitcase to the bedroom. It was a plain white envelope with nothing written on either side of it. The flap was not sealed. After putting the suitcase on the bed for unpacking, I opened the envelope. It contained a single, folded document. It was a photocopy of the face sheet of a Ventura County Sheriff's Department arrest report dated December 1, 2018. The suspect arrested on suspicion of fraud was identified on the form as Sam Scales. The summary stated that Scales had used the name Walter Lennon to set up a funding site to raise money for the families of victims killed in a mass shooting the month before in a bar in Thousand Oaks. I didn't need the arrest report to remember the incident at the Borderline Bar and Grill. A sheriff's deputy and 12 customers were killed. The money-raising scam appeared to be very similar to the one Scales went to prison in Nevada for. I walked into the home office to the desk where I had left my case files. I was sure that the Ventura County arrest was not on the rap sheet we had received in discovery from the district attorney's office. I opened the victim folder and found the arrest record. There was no listing of the arrest in December 2018. Kendall followed me into the office.
What is it? She asked.
An arrest report for Sam Scales, I said. A case over a year ago in Ventura County.
What does it mean?
Well, it's not on the rap sheet the prosecution gave us in discovery. The face sheet of the arrest report was a form with various windows and boxes below the handwritten summary. Under the box where fraud had been checked off was another checklist where the box marked Interstate had a slash through it. At the bottom of the list was a line where the author of the form had written, FBI, LA.
Were they trying to hide it from you? Kendall asked.
I looked up at her.
What?
Was the prosecutor trying to hide that arrest from you?
I think they didn't know about it. I think the FBI came and scooped Sam up.
Kendall looked confused, but I did not explain further. My mind was racing ahead to the possibilities of what the arrest report could mean.
I have to make a call, I said.
I pulled my phone and called Harry Bosch. He answered right away. Harry, it's me. I'm meeting Jennifer for lunch downtown, then I have to go to court. Can you meet us? I have something you need to see.
Where?
Rosso Blue at 1?
Rosso Blue? Where's that?
City Market South, off 11th.
I'll be there.
I disconnected. I felt a push of momentum. The arrest report could confirm a lot of things about Sam Scales and the case. It could also be a way to penetrate the FBI wall.
Who put that under the door? Kendall asked.
I thought about Agent Ruth, but didn't say her name.
I think it was somebody who wanted to do the right thing, I said.
Chapter 31. In anticipation of my return to custody, the courtroom had three times the number of deputies usually on hand for a hearing involving a non-custodial defendant. They were posted by the door, in the gallery, and on the other side of the gate. It was clear from the start that no one was planning on my leaving the way I had come in. My daughter had been unable to take me up on an invitation to lunch because of a class, but now was in the front row of the gallery, directly behind the defense table. She sat next to Lorna, who sat next to Cisco. I hugged Haley and spoke to each of them, trying to be encouraging, even though it was hard for me to be encouraged myself.
Dad, this is so unfair, Haley said.
Nobody ever said the law is fair, hey? I reminded her. Remember that. I moved down the line to Cisco. He had not been to lunch and didn't know about the arrest report that had been slipped under my door. I had chosen Bosch to run with it because of his law enforcement pedigree. I believed he was better suited to make contact with the Ventura County Sheriff's investigator who had arrested Sam Scales. Anything new? I asked. He knew I was talking about the surveillance and the hopes of locating Louis Aparicio. Not as of this morning, he said. The guy's a ghost. I nodded, disappointed, and then moved through the gate to the defense table, where I sat down alone and collected my thoughts. I had beat Jennifer to the courtroom from our lunch because she had to find parking in the black hole, while I'd had Bishop drop Kendall and me at the front door. I looked at notes from our lunch meeting and rehearsed in my mind what I would say to the judge. I had never been nervous or intimidated in a courtroom. I'd always felt at home and fed off the animosity that was usually directed at the defense from the prosecution table, the bench, sometimes even the jury box. But this was different. I knew that if I failed here, I would be the one who is escorted through the steel door into lockup. Before, when I was arrested, there had been no opportunity to argue my case before being booked. This time I had a chance. It was a long shot, because the state was within the rule of law in making its moves. But that didn't make it right, and I had to convince the judge of that. My concentration broke when I noticed Dana Berg and her bow-tied second take seats at the prosecution table. I didn't turn to look at them. I didn't say good afternoon. This had gotten personal, with Berg repeatedly seeking to take away my freedom to prepare my case unfettered. She was now the enemy, and I would treat her as such. Jennifer slid into the seat next to me. "Sorry, no parking in the black hole," she said. "I had to go down to a pay lot on Main." She seemed out of breath. The parking lot must have been more than a few blocks down Main. "No worries," I said. "I'm ready to go." She turned in her seat to acknowledge our line of supporters, then turned back to me. "Bosch not coming?" she asked. "I think he wanted to get going," I said. "You know, head up to Ventura." "Right. Listen, if this doesn't turn out the way we want it to, and I go back to Twin Towers, you'll need to deal with Bosch on the Ventura thing. Make sure there's no paper. He's not used to how we work things on the defense side. No paper, no discovery, okay?"
"Got it. But things are going to work out, Mickey. We're going to tag team them, and we are a damn good team."
"I hope so. I like your confidence. Even if the whole legislature and penal code is against us." I turned and made one more sweep of the gallery, making momentary eye contact with the two reporters that were in their usual places in the second row. A few minutes later, the deputy called the courtroom to order as Judge Warfield came through the door to chambers and took the bench.
"Back on the record with California versus Michael Haller," she said. "We have new charges filed in the case, warranting a custody and arraignment hearing, as well as a reading of the indictment. And we have a 686 motion from the defense as well. Let's start with the charges."
I waved a formal reading of the indictment.
"How do you plead?" Warfield asked.
"Not guilty," I said crisply.
"Very well," Warfield said. "Now let us take up the issue of pretrial release or detention. And I have a feeling we are going to have a lot of back and forth between the lawyers today, so let's remain at our respective tables to reduce traffic and time. Please speak loudly and clearly when addressing the court, so the record will be clear. What is the position of the people, Ms. Berg?"
Berg stood up at the prosecution table.
"Thank you, Your Honor," she began. "This morning, previous charges in this case were dropped after the Los Angeles County grand jury delivered an indictment of J. Michael Haller on a charge of first-degree murder under special circumstances outlined by the state legislature, to wit, murder for financial gain. It is the people's position that this is a no-bail offense, and we are seeking detention pending trial.
There is a presumption. I'm well aware of what the law presumes, Miss Berg, Warfield said. I am sure Mr. Holler is as well.
Warfield seemed annoyed by the state's effort to incarcerate me, and also by having her hands tied in the matter. She appeared to write something on a document up on the bench. She took a few moments to finish, before looking down at me.
Mr. Holler, I assume you want to be heard, she asked.
I rose from my seat. Yes, Your Honor, I said. But first, I'd like to know whether the state is seeking the death penalty under this new charge.
Good question, Warfield said. That would change things considerably, Ms. Berg. Has your office decided to seek the death penalty in your case against Mr. Holler?
No, Your Honor, Berg said. The people will waive the death penalty.
You have your answer, Mr. Holler, the judge said. Do you have anything else?
Yes, I do, Judge, I said. Legal precedent holds that once the death penalty has been taken off the table, this is no longer a capital case, notwithstanding that I face a sentence of life without parole. Ms. Berg must also convince the court that guilt is evident and the presumption thereof is great. In and of itself, the indictment is insufficient to prove that guilt is evident, and Miss Aronson will further address this issue.
Jennifer stood.
Your Honor, Jennifer Aronson, representing Mr. Holler on this issue, she said. Mr. Holler will argue the 686 motion himself when that comes up. As to the indictment before the court, it is the defense's position that the prosecution has gone outside the bounds of fair play to deprive Mr. Holler of his freedom as he prepares to defend himself in this matter. This is no more than a ploy to handicap Mr. Holler's ability to defend himself by putting him in a jail cell, where he cannot work full-time on his defense, is in constant danger from other prisoners, and risks his health as well.
She looked down at her notes before continuing.
The defense also challenges the allegation of special circumstances in this case, she said. Though we have not seen this new evidence that the prosecution claims will show Mr. Holler's financial gain from the murder of Samuel Scales, it is preposterous to think, let alone prove, that his death would in any way result in gain to Mr. Holler.
Warfield was again writing when Jennifer finished, and Berg took the opportunity to respond. She stood and addressed the judge while the pen was still moving in her hand.
Your Honor, the indictment by the grand jury precludes a preliminary hearing on the charges, and the state would object to turning this hearing into a determination of probable cause. The legislature is quite clear on that.
Yes, I know the rules, Miss Berg, Warfield said. But the legislature also gives a superior court judge in this state the power of discretion. I join Ms. Aronson in being troubled by this move by the prosecution. Are you prepared for the court to use its discretion and rule on bail in this matter without providing further support of probable cause?
A moment, Your Honor, Berg said.
For the first time today, I looked over at the prosecution table. Berg was conferring with her second. It was clear that the judge, a former defense attorney, did not approve of the game Berg was playing to put me back in jail. It was put up or shut up time, no matter what she had been able to run by the grand jury. I saw the second open one of the files in front of him and take out a document. He handed it to Berg, who then straightened up to address the court.
May it please the court, the people wish to call a witness in this matter, she said.
Who is the witness? Warfield asked.
Detective Kent Drucker. He will introduce a document that I am sure the court will see in support of probable cause regarding the special circumstances allegation.
Call your witness.
I had not seen Drucker earlier, but there he was in the front row of the gallery. He got up and went through the gate. He was sworn in and took the stand. Berg began by eliciting from him the details of the searches conducted of my home and warehouse, as well as the home of Lorna Taylor.
Let's talk specifically about the records you searched at the warehouse, Berg then said. What exactly were you looking at there?
These were non-privileged files relating to the business of Michael Haller's law practice, Drucker said.
In other words, the billing of clients.
Correct.
And was there a file relating to Sam Scales?
There were several, because Haller had represented him in a number of cases over the years.
And in searching these files, did you find any documents pertinent to your investigation of his murder?
I did. Berg then went through the formality with the judge of gaining approval to show the witness a document he had found in my files. I had no idea what it could be until the prosecutor dropped off a copy at the defense table after handing the judge's copy to her clerk. Jennifer and I leaned toward each other so we could read it at the same time. It was a copy of a letter apparently sent to Sam Scales in 2016 while he was awaiting sentencing for a fraud conviction. Dear Sam, this will be the last correspondence from me, and you will have to find yourself a new attorney to handle your sentencing next month if you do not pay the legal fees agreed to during our meeting of October 11th. My agreed-to fee for handling your case was $100,000 plus expenses with a $25,000 retainer. This agreement was made regardless of whether your case went to trial or was handled in disposition. It subsequently was handled by disposition, and sentencing is set. The remainder of the fee, $75,000, is now owed. I have handled several prior cases involving you as a defendant, and know that you keep a legal fund so that you can pay your lawyers for the good work they perform for you. Please pay this invoice or consider this the termination point of our professional relationship, with more serious action to follow. Sincerely, P.P. Michael Haller.
Lorna wrote this, I whispered. I never saw it. Besides, it means nothing.
Jennifer stood and objected.
Your Honor, may I voir dire? She asked.
It was a fancy way of asking if she could question the witness about the origin and relevancy of the document before the judge accepted it as a prosecution exhibit.
You may, Warfield said.
Detective Drucker, Jennifer began, this letter is unsigned, true?
That is true, but it was in Mr. Haller's files, Drucker said.
Do you know what the PP before Mr. Haller's printed name means?
It's Latin for pro per something.
Per procurationem. Do you know what it means?
That it was sent under his name, but he didn't actually sign it.
You said you found this in Mr. Haller's files, so it was never mailed.
We believe it is a copy, and the original was sent.
Based on what?
Based on it being found in a file marked correspondence. Why would he keep a file full of letters he didn't send? It makes no sense.
What evidence do you have that this letter was ever mailed or delivered directly to Mr. Scales?
I assume it was mailed or delivered. How else would Mr. Haller expect to get paid?
Do you have any evidence that Mr. Scales ever received this letter?
Again, no. But that is not what is important about the letter.
Then what is important about the letter?
Mr. Haller says he knows that Sam Scales kept a fund to pay his lawyer, and he wanted another $75,000. That is motive to kill.
Do you suppose that Mr. Haller knew about the fund because Sam Scales told him?
That would make sense.
Did Sam Scales reveal to Mr. Haller where he kept that fund and how to access it?
I have no idea, but it would be covered under attorney-client privilege.
If you can't show that Mickey Haller knows where Sam Scales kept his money, how can you claim that he killed Sam Scales for his money?
Berg had had enough and stood.
I object, Your Honor, she said. This isn't voir dire. Ms. Aronson is conducting a discovery deposition.
I can see what she is doing, Ms. Berg, Warfield said, and she has made her point. Anything further, Ms. Aronson?
Jennifer checked me, and I gave a slight shake of my head, reminding her that a lawyer should always quit talking when she's ahead.
No further questions at this time, Your Honor, she said. It is clear from the detective's testimony, as well as the document, that it was not signed or written by Mr. Haller and has no relevancy to this hearing.
Judge, the relevancy is clear, Berg countered. Whether or not it was signed by the defendant, it was sent by his office and it references a meeting he attended. It is clearly relevant because it speaks to the issues and motives surrounding this case, that the defendant was owed money and he knew that Sam Scales, the victim, had the money and wouldn't part with it. We have further documentation we are ready to present that shows the defendant filed a lien against the victim in furtherance of collecting his money. That lien is now lodged against the estate. If money is found, the defendant is in line to receive it plus interest. He could not get Sam Scales to pay him in life. He hopes to collect from him in death.
Objection! Jennifer yelled.
Ms. Berg, you know better, Warfield said. Leave your sound bites for the reporters, not this court.
Yes, Your Honor, Berg said, her tone falsely contrite. The judge dismissed Drucker from the witness stand. I knew it was fruitless. The judge would either be canny and object to what the prosecution was doing, or let it slide. Warfield asked if there was any further argument, and Berg demurred, while Jennifer asked to address the court.
Thank you, Your Honor, she said. The court noted earlier that it has wide discretion over bail. The bail schedule is meant to protect the community, as well as ensure that defendants accused of crimes are held to answer. To these points, I believe it is clear that Michael Haller is neither a threat to the community nor a threat to flee. He has been free on bond now for 6 weeks, and he hasn't attempted to flee. He hasn't threatened the community or anyone associated with this case. In fact, he has sought and received the court's permission to leave the county and state, and yet returned the same night. Your Honor, you do have discretion in the matter, and it is in pursuit of a fair trial in this case that I ask that bond be carried over from the original charge, and that Mr. Haller be allowed to remain free to defend himself.
Berg's comeback was only to remind the judge that rules were rules. She said judicial discretion did not extend to the findings of a grand jury or to the legislature's decision to make murder for financial gain a no-bail charge. She then sat down. I didn't think we had a winning argument, but the judge built anticipation in the courtroom as she wrote notes before speaking.
We'll hear the other motion before I make a decision on this matter, she said. We are going to take a 10-minute break first, and then we'll consider Mr. Haller's 686 motion. Thank you.
The judge quickly left the bench, and I was left with 10 minutes to figure out how to turn things around. Chapter 32. It might have been my last chance to walk the halls of the courthouse, even ride the elevator down and step outside, to enjoy a few moments of free, fresh air. But I remained at the defense table during the 10-minute break, which actually lasted 20. I wanted to be alone with my thoughts. I even told Jennifer I didn't want her next to me when court resumed. She might have been hurt, but she understood my reasoning. It was me against the state, and while I would not be speaking to a jury, I wanted the judge to be reminded of the fact that I was one man, standing alone against the power and might of the beast. I composed myself to be ready at the 10-minute mark, and then dealt with the anxiety of waiting in overtime. Finally, Warfield came out and retook her position on the bench above everyone.
Very well, back on the record, she said. We have a motion from the defense to compel a speedy trial. Mr. Haller, I see you are now alone at the defense table. You will be arguing this motion?
I stood up. Yes, Your Honor, I said.
Very well, Warfield said. I hope we can be succinct. Proceed.
If it please the court, I will be succinct. What the prosecution has done with its grand jury indictment is attempt to subvert the law and my constitutionally guaranteed right to a speedy trial. It's a shell game, Your Honor, played by the prosecution, not in the furtherance of justice, but in the gaming of it.
There have been two constants since the very first minutes of this case. One is that I have steadfastly denied these charges and claimed my innocence. The other is my refusal, under any circumstances, to delay these proceedings for any amount of time. I paused for a moment and looked down at the notes I had scribbled on my legal pad. I didn't need them. I was on a roll. But I wanted the space so the judge could take in my argument in pieces. Since day one, I have demanded my right to a speedy trial, I continued. I have said put up or shut up to the state. I did not commit this crime, and I demand my day in court. And as that day has drawn closer, and the prosecution knows it's almost time, they have blinked. They know their case is weak. They know it is full of holes. They know I have innocence and reasonable doubt on my side, and they have attempted to thwart my defense at every turn. I paused again, this time turning slightly to look back at my daughter and offer a wistful smile. No man should have his daughter see him in this position. I turned back. Judge, every lawyer's got a bag of tricks. Prosecutor, defense attorney, doesn't matter. There is nothing pure about the law when you get inside a courtroom. It's a bare-knuckle fight, and each side uses whatever it can to bludgeon the other. The Constitution guarantees me a speedy trial, but by dropping the original charge and talking a grand jury into a new one, the prosecution is trying to bludgeon me in two ways. Stick me in a jail cell so I am handicapped in preparing my defense, and restart the game clock so the state has more time to wield its power and might and shore up their losing case against me. This time I kept my eyes on the judge as I paused before the wind-up. Is it legal? Is it within code? Perhaps. I'll give them that. But is it fair? Is it in the pursuit of justice? Not a chance. You can stick me back in jail. You can delay the search for truth that a trial is supposed to be. But it won't be the right thing to do, and it won't be fair. The court holds a lot of discretion in this regard, and the defense urges you not to restart the clock. Let's get to the search for the truth now, instead of later, instead of at the prosecution's convenience. Thank you, Your Honor. If my words had any impact on Warfield, she didn't show it. She didn't write down anything as she had during the earlier motion. She simply swiveled 6 inches in her high-backed leather chair, so that her gaze shifted from me to the prosecution table. "Ms. Berg," she said, "would the state like to respond?" "Yes, Your Honor," Berg said. "I promise to be more succinct than the defense. In fact, Mr. Haller made my argument for me. What we have done with the refiling of the case through grand jury indictment